right? We got a lot of different things coming at you today, okay? And I'm just sensing a little bit of a lull right now. We don't got time for that. All right, let's go. Break it. Let it cross. Woo!
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention? I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story. And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
You're listening to Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on the new FM 1017 and 1320 KLWN.
Hey, what's happening? Welcome in. Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 1017 and 1320 KLWN. I am Nick Schwert. Happy to have you with us on a lovely Thursday afternoon here in Lawrence. Out early tonight at 5:30, but we got a lot to get to between now and then. Emile DeAndres, the author of Hard to Grip, a really, really fascinating book. I would highly suggest checking it out. And there are some local Lawrence University of Kansas ties in there. He's going to join us coming up 20 minutes from now. The voice of the Chiefs, Mitch Holtis, as he is every day during Chiefs training camp at 4:15. And Scott Chasen, who spent his summer up in Chicago. Now he's coming back to God's country, and he'll be working with the LJ World covering KU this year, and he's going to join us coming up at the top of the 5 o'clock hour. But before we get to any of that, a pressing issue, I am dubbing it the curse of the kitten. Last night, the Royals fall to the Cardinals 8-5, and there have been a lot of weird little things that have caught on with Royals fans over the last 5 years. The rally sauce, the barbecue rally with Billy Butler. Then there was
the praying mantis.
The rally mantis. My favorite was I should have looked at the guy from South Korea who came over during the 2014 World Series run. I should know his name. Do you know his name?
No.
I know
who you're talking about.
I wanted to say Siwoo Kim, but I know for a fact that's a golfer.
I think he actually came back over this year.
I wanted to say Ling Song, but I know for a fact that was a foreign exchange student from my freshman year at KU. I can't remember his name, but that was another big rally cry. Now, the guy's name, Sungwoo Lee. I was close. Sungwoo. So you have Sungwoo, you have the rally barbecue sauce, you have the rally mantis. Earlier this year, they tried to get something going with the coffee, the Sledgiato stuff with Peter Moylan. That didn't really work. And I feel like they do it every year, which I'm totally fine with because it's usually funny. But last night, they got a bit of a taste of their own medicine. And I wonder if St. Louis is going to use this to their advantage because bases loaded. Yadier Molina at the plate. Royals up 5-4 when a kitten ran on the field. And it took probably 2-3 minutes to get the cat off the field. Were you watching this live? This guy is probably just a facilities guy, ran onto the field to get the cat. Lorenzo Cain, who the cat walked right by, wanted nothing to do with it. And this dude runs onto the field to get the cat. You know, what's the big deal? Pick up a kitten and run him back off the diamond. But he picks it up by the back. Like, he just picks it up, like, around its rib cage, which is a huge no-no with cats because they're going to claw you and they're going to bite you. And the cat was clawing and scratching and biting this dude. And you can see him mouthing explicitives as he's running off the field because it was scratching and biting him. And Steve Fisiok's telling him, oh, you can't do that. You got to pick it up by the back of the neck. So it was kind of a funny little moment. They finally get the cat off the field. Next pitch from Peter Moylan. Yadier Molina hits it out of the park for a grand slam. And the Cardinals win 8-5. And it does seem like the exact opposite of what the Royals have benefited from over the last 4 years. These weird little ticks that happen during games or in the clubhouse that happen to coincide with really remarkable Royals runs. And they haven't had one of those this year. You wondered if the cat would work in their favor. It's not. It's the Cardinals thing. They win for the third straight night.
Are we seriously analyzing this? Like, this is what's going to kill their season?
I'm not saying it's going to kill their season, but it could be the smoking gun that we look back on.
So we're going to look back.
We're not going to look back at Alex Gordon's sub 200 batting average. We're not going to look back at Alcides Escobar being the worst offensive player in the league. We're not going to look back on the inconsistencies from the starting rotation or the lack of depth in the bullpen. We're going to look back on a cute little kitten that ran under the field in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. We're just going to be sitting there. Why couldn't it have been the Mantis?
Right. Well, if it would have been a black cat, you would have thought, okay, that's really weird. It was a cute little gray kitten. And I don't even know why this has happened, but the Cardinals issued an official statement. And the title says, Cardinals Statement Regarding the Hashtag Rallycat. So I'm guessing this is a little tongue-in-cheek. Here's what it says. As everyone observed during last night's game, Lucas Hackman, a member of our grounds crew, secured the stray cat in the outfield and exited the playing surface at the left field gate and walked up towards the main concourse at gate 3. He then let the cat down outside of gate 3 near the Stan Musial statue and went immediately to first aid to attend to his scratch and bite injuries. And that's kind of a sissy move, right? Cat scratch.
Yeah, no crying in baseball.
Cat scratch fever. At that point, as our ushers tried to contain the cat, a fan grabbed it and claimed it was hers. As she left the ballpark, our security team caught up with her and asked her some questions. She then abruptly left with the cat. So, serious controversy there. We understand from media accounts that the woman intended to take it home and care for it, but lost track of it in City Garden.
So we're just taking her word. There could be a cat thief on the loose here.
Well, I don't think they did take her word. It sounds like she was a little bit abrasive and tried to get out of there with the cat before they could ask her any more questions.
I want her arrested and questioned.
I do, too. We are hopeful someone will find the cat and contact us so we can properly care for it. Our grounds crew is working on developing a stray animal protocol to ensure the safety of both crew and animal should this happen again. In the meantime, the Cardinals are looking to scratch and claw their way back to the top of the division standings. You had me until that last line. You had me until you tried to get cute with it.
That was terrible.
That's so awful. I wanted this to become a rally thing for the Cardinals. Now I hope it dooms their season. Not that I'll ever really root for the Cardinals, but if you're going to root for weird little things to start rallies for the Royals, you can't say that they're dumb when other teams do it, right? Like, you have to kind of accept, we have our own things, you have your own things. It happened to be at our expense last night, but the curse of the kitten, I think, is something that we're not going to forget about anytime soon.
Do you think this is kind of like the placebo effect? Like, tangibly, this has no effect on anything.
Does it?
But
what makes you say
well,
that?
Well, I guess it kind of does if you're going to believe it, like the placebo effect, where, like, you take a sugar pill, but you don't know it's a sugar pill,
right,
and then whatever percentage of people ends up feeling better. It could be like that, like, to where you convince yourself, oh, this is going to be a rally mantis or a rally kitten now. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden in your mind, you're feeling better, you're feeling more loose, and then all of a sudden you play better because of it.
Right.
Even though it's not, like, directly because of that. It's kind of like the placebo effect in that way.
I agree, but I think more so than that, the biggest thing that affected was that Peter Moylan had to stand on the mound with the bases loaded for an additional 3 minutes as he's trying to get out of a jam. And he didn't. And it's not like Peter Moylan, he's not Wade Davis, he's not a cyborg, he's not a guy who it doesn't matter, like, he's going to strike this guy out and you're going to get out of a jam. That probably didn't help our guy, Sledge, as the nickname that he's dubbing himself with for Nickname Weekend.
Well, then, conspiracy. Did the Cardinals have something to do with this? Did they purposely
plant the kitten?
Did they wait for the perfect opportunity to send it out? I mean, if this lady wasn't technically caught or questioned,
right, because,
like, she could have been a Cardinals employee and they just don't want people to know.
Because let's talk about this. How the hell does a kitten get into the stadium in the first place? Right?
Because if you're bringing in a bag, they're checking the bag. And obviously a kitten's going to be pretty inevitable.
Is St. Louis that run down and dilapidated where stray cats are just roaming the streets and walking into the baseball stadium?
I wouldn't rule that out.
I wouldn't either, because their baseball stadium is downtown. So is it that inconceivable to think that a stray cat could just wander into the grounds? I don't know. But all I'll know is this. The statement, the fact that the Cardinals issued a statement with a humorous undertone, to me, sounds like they're trying to pull the wool over our heads. Like, hey, we're going to make this into a joke. That way, you just completely forget about any idea of this being a plant by us, right? If we make it into a joke, we all have a laugh about it. Nobody's pointing a finger at us and saying, how'd that cat get in there in the first place? Not only how did it get into the stadium, how did it get down onto the field without anybody stopping it or seeing it or anybody saying, that's weird. It's just a cat walking around a baseball game. I've been to a lot of baseball games, Derek. I've never seen a cat just walking around.
I think they showed their cards too early. I'm just going ahead. I'm 100% assuming that they planted this. I think they did it way too early. Why would you use it now in the middle of the regular season? Why not wait until like the end of the season if you really need it? Because what if you don't need it this year? You might need it next year. You might need it if you make the playoffs.
It's a good point. Like in a regular season game with a month and a half to go, is that really the time when you want to play that card? Probably not. Like maybe you hold that in the bag for a little bit while longer and use it when you really need it. What if this becomes a thing in St. Louis now? Cats just running onto the field every week. That's going to raise some questions, right? People are going to go, this is odd. I've never seen, I mean, I know that there have been cats. What was the famous, the black cat curse? That was in Chicago, right? The Chicago Cubs, when a black cat ran onto the field. That was a long time ago, though. That was a black cat.
Yeah.
And black cats are known for curses. Cute little gray and silver kittens aren't.
That's the thing, too. Like, a kitten, like, it made its way all the way through. It navigated the baseball stadium. It got around any security guards. It got by any fans. Got by all the players. Like, how did a kitten do all this?
A kitten, right? Not a lot of brain power in cats. Because that's the thing with dogs versus cats. The reason why people buy dogs, and I'm fine with cats. Like, whatever. But you get a puppy and you think it's going to be a puppy forever, but it doesn't. It grows up. You know what it does? It turns into a pretty cool dog that can do stuff for you, with you. You get a cute little kitten, you think it's going to be a kitten forever. It doesn't. And then it just grows up to be a cat. And it just kind of lays around and slinks around your house and licks its paws. Like, cats don't really do anything. Dogs, I could understand. So like if a dog ran out of the field, I'd be cool with it. But a cat running onto the field, you got to stop that. Come on. We can't have stray cats just wandering our streets. Maybe in St. Louis, there's no protocol on that. But in this part of the country and pretty much everywhere else, there's proper decorum. Let's clean it up, St. Louis. 317, New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. We're going to talk to Emil DeAndres coming up in the next segment. He's got a very interesting story. He wrote about it in his memoir. It's called Hard to Grip. You can hear from him on the other side. Welcome back to Rock Chalk Sports Talk, New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. We've got a really interesting guest joining us now on the program. His name is Emil DeAndres, and the name of his book is Hard to Grip. It's a memoir. This guy's got an unbelievable story. At the age of 22, he was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, seemingly in the midst of a really promising baseball career just before he was set to pitch professionally in Belgium. The story kind of chronicles his baseball career dealing with rheumatoid arthritis and how he was able to cope with it and move on with his life. He joins us now on the program. Emil, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. How are you?
I'm great, and thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us. So, kind of take us back to life before you were diagnosed. What was your career like? What was kind of your mindset going to pitch professionally? Kind of take us through that time of your life.
Yeah, so I pitched for 4 years at the University of Hawaii, Hilo. I was a relief pitcher. I kind of stacked up a bunch of appearances as a pitcher out there. We actually played, I don't know where you guys are in relation to University of Kansas or Wichita State.
Yeah, we're actually in, we are in Lawrence where KU is located.
Oh, wow. I mean, we play, there's actually a significant chapter in my book dedicated just to my experience playing Wichita State. And I think their coach is named Richie Price. We played him for four straight years. We knew all their players and stuff like that. And so there's actually like a lot of, there's a lot of dedication, page-wise, to Kansas baseball in the early 2000, or like mid 2005, 2008, when all the coaches' sons were on the team, actually. So, anyways, I played against them, and I pitched a bunch. And basically, at the end of my career, you know, I was a left-handed pitcher that didn't throw too hard, so I didn't really have many scouts coming to games and sort of eyeing me for a major league team, but I knew that I'd experienced marginal success as a pitcher out there and wanted to continue my career. And so Europe seemed to be like the most practical avenue for professional baseball. And so I put a video of my bullpen up on YouTube, and I got a contract to go play in Belgium, and that was where I was set to go.
And at what juncture in this kind of transition did you find out about being diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis?
So like in the same month that I got this contract, I started to feel, you know, a weird sensation in my pitching elbow. And that over the course of a week or so spread to other parts of my body and quite rapidly. I'd been going to a sports doctor, and the sports doctor decided to refer me to a rheumatologist. And that was when I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. And this is all in the course of like 1 month. It was really, really rapid.
So before that, you were just a normal, healthy pitching prospect, right? You didn't have any idea that this thing was kind of looming?
No, I mean, there's a part at the beginning of my book where I sort of recall these sort of mysterious phantom swellings that I would experience just for like one semester in high school, where I would wake up and like be unable to lift my shoulder, or lift my arm, I should say. And, or it would cause excruciating pain, but then it would just disappear the next day as if it had never happened. And so I had like, I don't know, traces of something literally for like 3 months once in high school. But it came and went so quickly. It was almost like a figment of my imagination. So other than that, this came on, really unexpectedly.
His name is Emil DeAndres. The name of the book is Hard to Grip. It's a fascinating read. So what was the initial reaction? How did you find out that you were being diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis? What was that like?
Well, you know, I went through denial just because rheumatoid arthritis is not like, I mean, it's one of the most uncommon things that can happen to a young man. Rheumatoid arthritis, I would come to find, is almost like statistically only attacks middle-aged women. And so here I was like kind of in the physical prime of my life and sort of with an athlete's mentality, kind of stubborn and proud, being told that I was going to suddenly have the body of more or less an old woman for the rest of my life. And so I was in denial. I refused to take the medication that they prescribed me because I felt if I took the medication, that meant I was admitting to myself that I actually had this disease.
I mean, was it immediately over for you? Did you continue to try and play through it, or was that kind of a game ender for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, so initially when the disease was fresh and it was just in my elbow, I would still try and, you know, do a bunch of push-ups and play long toss every day because, you know, when you pitch your whole life, you wake up with feeling weird sometimes in your arm. And those kinds of things you tell yourself you have to play through if you want to be an athlete. And so I was used to playing through things like this. But then, you know, rheumatoid arthritis without medication, I mean, that is an unstoppable force. There's no denying it. There's no playing through it eventually. And so I definitely pushed myself to that point where the disease kind of took over my body. Like I was having a hard time getting upstairs and toweling myself off after a shower. So there was no, I mean, my life had to just go in a different direction.
And I imagine it wasn't coming down with something that bothered you. Like if you had to have Tommy John surgery, or you had swelling in your knee or in your elbow, like that's one thing. Those are injuries that athletes and particularly baseball players are used to dealing with. They're pretty common amongst the sport, but having something like this, was that the part that was the most difficult to deal with? Like, this isn't the type of disorder, this isn't the type of injury, even though it's not an injury, that guys like me are supposed to deal with?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I when my career ended before it began, and people were asking, oh, what happened? I actually, like you said, I preferred to keep it sort of vague and keep it kind of like sports injury sounding when I told other people, because I didn't want anybody to know that I had this disease. I thought it just felt incredibly vulnerable to have this sort of, I mean, it felt like an emasculating disease to have. And so when people asked, or when I told people, it was just like, yeah, I blew out my arm, or it turns out my elbow is kind of shot, or, you know, and then people would ask, oh, well, can you get surgery or something? I'd just be like, nah, it's just blown out, you know, and I just kept it like as ambiguous as I could so that was the impression that was left upon them. Cause yeah, I totally felt that way. I felt this disease was really an embarrassing thing to have.
What was the kind of the support staff around you? I mean, what kinds of reactions were you getting from your friends, from your family members, from your teammates?
Yeah, well, I mean, because I was embarrassed and because I wasn't telling many people, I was kind of putting myself in a position where I wouldn't get support, and that was kind of how I wanted it. So beyond my parents, who, you know, I was on their health care, and so they knew I was going to these visits, and they were, you know, checking up on me, and my mom wanted to go to as many with me as she could just because she wanted to get as much information as she could. She wasn't getting any from me. Other than that, I kept it to myself. So people, you know, even my best friends, didn't really know the extent as to what was happening. And my girlfriend, who would then become my wife, at the time we were doing long distance because she went to school in South Carolina, and the only way we saw each other was Skype. And I even kind of kept it from her as much as I could as well. I kind of just hid it.
What was the turning point when you did kind of come to accept reality? What was there a smoking gun? Was there like a turning point, or was it more of a process sort of deal?
Yeah, there was like, well, in the book, I sort of document all these different avenues I attempt to go down to treat my symptoms before taking the actual medication. So I go on this sort of like holistic quest of like, I go to a Chinese herbalist, which is kind of a funny moment in the book because there are so many language barriers. I'm not even really sure what's happening in the room, but I don't ever really heal, and it ends up being really expensive. So I go through that, and then I try different food allergy tests, and I augment my diet, and I try all these different things, hoping that, you know, they will alleviate the symptoms somehow. And it keeps on getting worse. And there's a point in the book where finally I take all the stuff out of my diet, and I'm eating like the diet of a deer, basically, for like a month, and nothing happens, and my body is just shutting down. I'm like, I have to take the medication. And that was kind of when I understood that this is the new person I am now.
How long was that from when you got diagnosed to when you finally came around and started taking that medication?
I think it was around 6 months, which is a really long time to have this disease and not treat it with medication. And like 6 months with rheumatoid arthritis is way too much time to allow it to spread. And so I was, by the end of it, I was like I said, I was almost a cripple.
So then you finally, you make peace with it, you make peace with your situation. What was kind of the next step for you? Did you have any idea what you were going to do with the rest of your life?
No, that's the thing. Like, it was, I think it sucks for it sucks for a lot of people who graduate college with a degree and then move home and don't even know what they're going to do and find a hard time getting a job, yeah. Which was, that's like the worst college hangover. And I was definitely, one of those people. And it was just a little bit, there was like a level of complexity to it because this was kind of being thrust in my face because I already thought I had a career. Or at least I thought that I was going to be playing baseball for a few more years to just sort of put off joining the real world, you know? So, going home and, you know, I was so used to spending hours and hours a day on the baseball field. Like when, you know, either playing long toss or throwing in a bullpen or lifting weights or jogging fences or whatever. Like I was like, when you spent like 3 hours of your life every day, or 3 hours of your day, your whole life on the baseball field, it's tough to suddenly like have that window of free time. And so I needed to find something that would kind of challenge me and stimulate me the way baseball had. And I looked to writing because I majored in creative writing in college. And so that was what I ended up doing to sort of start occupying my time.
And baseball, I feel like, is unique in the fact from other sports. I mean, if you are playing at a high level, which you clearly were, pretty much from when you're a little kid all the way till the end of your career, it is a 12-month out-of-the-year job. It is unbelievably time-consuming. Every sport is if you make it to that level. But I imagine with baseball, it's particularly unique because for a lot of people in your situation, like, that's all you know for the first 20-some-odd years of your life.
Yeah, and, you know, my case is a little bit unique, too, because I don't know how many – if there's any Kansas baseball players from that time period listening, they might remember. I was like I was the slowest throwing pitcher on our team. Like I threw like high 70s, low 80s with like, I mean, my curveball was legitimately clocked in the 50s at one point. And so, I mean, I threw clown balls like, every pitch. And so when you're playing Division I baseball and you're playing teams like Kansas and Wichita State and, you know, Florida State and stuff like that, and you're throwing all those clown pitches, like baseball suddenly becomes a very mental game. Like I wasn't going in there up there and just blindly throwing heaters past bats. I was having to sort of, you know, strategize. And so that was what was fun about the game for me. That was like, that was part of the game. You know, working your way through tough situations like that. And so I found writing, was the kind of craft that challenged me and stimulated me and occupied my mind, the way baseball had.
Emil DeAndre is joining us here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. The name of the book is Hard to Grip. So you mentioned how you started writing. Did somebody push you in that direction, or was that kind of something that you did on your own?
In becoming a writer and becoming interested in being a writer, that happened at the university where I in the undergrad level. I had a teacher who was like sort of neurotically enthusiastic about writing, and he kind of like, you either drank his Kool-Aid or didn't, and I ended up drinking his Kool-Aid, and he like convinced me to sort of, you know, to pursue writing and to sort of explore my creativity and find out if I really did like, you know, writing stories and crafting, you know, stories and stuff like that. And I did. And so I ended up majoring in creative writing just because I enjoyed my time in his class. You know, it was like a very welcome sort of juxtaposition to being on the baseball field with a bunch of jocks, even, you know. And so that was a cool balance for me. And that was definitely what got me into writing in the first place.
At what juncture did you begin writing this book?
Pretty quick. Like I was diagnosed in 2008, 2009-ish, and I was writing this book by 2011. And so I kind of wrote about my experience with the disease in real time. And then once the book was done, when I felt it was finally done, I just went through and edited it because my writer's voice changed a ton over the course of 6 years. And I actually wrote my first book that was published in the middle of writing this book. So like I started in 2011, and then an opportunity came along to write another book, which I took. So this Hard to Grip book went on hiatus for a couple of years, and then I returned to it. So that, you know, like all these different writers' voices sort of came into me and left. And so it left a draft of this book that had like a wide range of narrative voices. And so I kind of did a lot of editing as a result. But yeah, I mean, I wrote it for about 5 years and it went through a few different drafts for sure.
See, that's interesting to me because I feel like most stories like this would be retrospective. They would be written after the fact, but you've kind of got the best of both worlds. I imagine if you would have just waited to write all of it 5, 6, 7 years down the line, it'd probably read as an entirely different book.
I think so. Especially the sort of emotional fury. And my book is really anecdotal. So I think a lot of the key scenes in the book would have been forgotten, or the sharpness of them would have been sort of dialed down or watered down a little bit just from time past. And I think telling my like the anger and the frustration in those moments keeps it pretty honest. And I agree, it would have been a lot, like writing it retrospectively would have sort of indulged the emotions a little bit too much and kept them a little bit inauthentic.
Beyond writing, what do you do now, Emil?
I teach English at a community college about 20 minutes south of San Francisco, and I coach baseball at the high school where I once played baseball, and also at the college where I teach English. So I'm just balancing like coaching, teaching, and writing on a weekly basis.
How does your story affect you as a coach, if it does at all?
That's a good question. I mean, you know what it does? Because people ask questions similar to that. They're like, do you tell your story to your kids and remind them how difficult it is to achieve your dreams or something like that? And like, no, I don't do that. I don't try to use my story as like a warning to kids who are aspiring to be something. But what I do I mean, I now love the game of baseball more than I ever did as a player, I think. And that's because I had it for so long. It was taken away from me. I resented it. I reaccepted it. And now I accept my role as like a teacher of it and like just a general lover of the game rather than just like a hardcore competitor. And with that sort of deeper level of love, I really do try and reflect that and upon the players. I want them not to fear losing it and to understand how hard it is for them to ever, you know, accomplish anything great in the game. But I do want them to understand how great of a game it is and how much they will remember these times later in their lives.
The name of the book is Hard to Grip. Emil, where can people buy this if they want to check it out?
It's in bookstores in the sports section, but also Amazon makes it just one click away.
And it's the name of the book, Hard to Grip, Emil DeAndres. I mean, it is a very gripping story. It's pretty thought-provoking. There's some pretty sad moments. There's some moments that'll make you laugh. A really good read, Emil. I appreciate you taking a few minutes to come on the program and talk to us about it.
Thanks a lot, man.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Quarter after four, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. The Chiefs will get their preseason underway tomorrow night against the San Francisco 49ers as we welcome on the voice of the Chiefs, Mitch Holthus. Mitch, what's the night before the first game of the season look like for you? How do you get your mind right?
Well, I go back through all of our Rock Chalk Sports Talk segments that we've done the last 2 weeks, review every one of those just to kind of hone it, watch some tape, and then, you know, watch some fire-up videos, basically. So, you know, seeing what's, you know, get me ready to go, like some, you know, the typical fire-up movie. So that's where we're at.
I can't imagine you sleep much the night before a game. You and Andy Reid are probably similar in that regard.
Yeah, and I've got the whiteboard like he's got. It's just Russell Crowe and a beautiful mind. I'm trying to, you know, I call mathematicians from all of the region schools in Kansas and go, give me your hardest problem. And then I'm, you know, working on trying to take care of it. So I have to do something to occupy my mind, or otherwise it just rolls, you know.
Well, I know that the game plan for quarterbacks tomorrow is pretty much everybody gets a quarter. Alex Smith gets the first, then Bray, then Mahomes in the third quarter, and then Joel Stave in the last quarter. What's kind of what's the theory behind using the quarterbacks like that?
Well, and I'd kind of pump the brakes on that. I mean, that's the template going into it, but that could be out the window by the second drive. Meaning if Alex comes out with the first team and rolls out there with a 10-play 80-yard touchdown drive, you know, he's not going to be out there the whole first quarter. Just me guessing.
Mm-hmm.
And that means then I could see Bray going the rest, going a quarter and a half. And then Mahomes starts the third quarter, possibly into the fourth. I mean, I don't think it's going to be – if there's a 7-play drive at the 22-yard line, ooh, the quarter's over – I don't think they're going to run in a new quarterback just to stay on the
sure.
1, 2, 3, 4. So I just think it's a totally situation. And this is why I'm going to sell our broadcast here. Well, it's compelling to listen to this game, even if you watch it, because our crew's been there every day. You know, we breathe it. It's as important to who is surrounding that quarterback at the time. For example, let's say that Alex goes 10 plays, 80 yards, touchdown, and Andy goes, that's enough, let's put Bray in. But who's the line with Bray? Does he still have the first team offensive line? And what does that mean? Or who's the skill guys around him? That's as much, I mean, that's as important as exactly who is quarterbacking. Same with Mahomes. Who's going out there with him? Would they keep the number two offensive line out there an extra couple series just to have, so that Patrick has those guys instead of the third unit, and then a few guys that would make up the fourth.
Well, I imagine that makes it incredibly difficult to go back and analyze after the fact, right? Like, if you want to look at how Patrick Mahomes did in the third quarter and you see, well, he's playing with some second-team guys, he's playing with some third-team guys, he's playing against some second- and third-team guys from the other team as well, like, how does the coaching staff go back and try and analyze that?
Well, it's all part of the input that you do when you analyze the game.
let me just give an example, too, with the skill guys. Mahomes really likes hooking up with a rookie wide receiver from Hawaii, Marcus Kemp, who is a very good receiver at Hawaii. Now, he's not going to make the team, but he might be on the practice squad. Another guy is Gary Dieter, who played 1 year at Alabama as a graduate transfer after being in Bowling Green. We call him Sprockets for the old Saturday Night Live skit. You know, we dance now on Sprockets. But he's a good receiver, good player. Now, are those guys going to be out there with Mahomes? Or, wait a minute, maybe they put a Albert Wilson or a Chris Conley out there with Mahomes or a Shontavious Jones, who would be up the depth chart and a chance to make the team ahead of a Kemp or a Dieter. And to your point, and to answer your question, all of that goes into play in the analysis. Not just what they do and how they do it, but who's out there with them and how do they integrate those people or overcome them sometimes if you've got a substandard offensive lineman.
We're talking to the voice of the Chiefs, Mitch Holtis, here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Maybe this isn't a fair question, but how is Alex Smith kind of handling or dealing with the Patrick Mahomes hype? Is it even something that he has to, quote, deal with?
Oh, you know, he's dealt with it exactly like I thought he would. He just doesn't – it doesn't bother him. He's going about his business like he has the four previous camps to this one. You got to understand, man, he's been around the block like 15 times. A 13-year veteran, a 1-1 pick. The only thing I don't know, I mean, there's got to be a little scar tissue. He'd never show it to you about what happened in San Francisco in 2012 with Kaepernick. Because he's gone 13-3, 7-2-1. He's rolling with that team. He gets a concussion. He never gets to play again. And that team goes to the Super Bowl. And so you got to be thinking in the back of his mind, man, I wish I could have finished that out. Not saying that that factors into this situation, but you know he's got to be thinking about it. But he never, I mean, the quarterbacks are always together. They eat lunch together, breakfast together, their meetings together. There's no, they're not looking at you like you're the new kid in school and I'm jealous. Or I mean, it's none of that. So Alex Smith's a pro. I've told you that for 5 years, and nothing has changed with Mahomes being in the camp.
And I'm sure the Chiefs and Alex Smith included knew that when Patrick Mahomes drafted, you know, top 15 pick in the draft, like people are going to get excited about that, and that's what you want, right? You want you want the fans to be excited because you've got a shiny new toy. But how insulated are they from the noise, the people saying they can't wait to see Patrick Mahomes out there? Are they even aware that people are out there clamoring and that they're going to be across the course of the season?
Yeah, but here's the thing, but we're all going through this together for the first time. Now, I broadcast the Chiefs for 24 years, but we haven't taken a first-year quarterback in 37. That precedes me by 13, okay? So, and even the media and the fans haven't done this. Now, they're always clamoring to do it, but then you finally do it. Everybody's kind of got to see how this works. And not if Alex throws a pick or it's a three and out, like, got to get Mahomes in. I mean, I kind of chuckled. I was driving back from St. Joe this morning, heard an ad for an apparel company go, get your Chiefs jerseys. Wasn't a Chiefs ad. It was another company, but get your Chiefs jerseys. Get an Eric Berry. Get a Justin Houston. Get a Patrick Mahomes. I mean, Patrick Mahomes hasn't even played yet. So it's a dynamic. It's human nature. But, I mean, let's call Green Bay and Seattle and see how you do this. Even as a fan base, as in a media grouping.
You mentioned Albert Wilson earlier. What are the expectations for him? We've talked about a lot of the wide receivers heading into this first preseason game. He's not a name we've talked a ton about. What are his expectations, both for himself and internally, for this season?
Nick, he's got to become a player that can make a play when it's not scheme for him. I'm going to give a basketball analogy. Bill Self's going to set up plays. You know, he's got that cool weave. He's got that flip-back play that Chalmers hit the shot on, right, in 08. Okay, he runs that all the time as a late game. That's a scheme. Then there are times you just break somebody down off the dribble. Well, that's the same thing in the NFL. That's what Tyreek Hill does. You don't have to go, well, let's think of the perfect play so Tyreek Hill gets open. He'll get open. For Albert Wilson, his big plays have all been on schemes. And so that's okay. That's going to happen because that's one of the strengths of Andy Reid. But it can't be just that. You've got to just break him down off the dribble as a wide receiver at times. Win a battle if it's a crossing pattern and some guy's just all over you in man defense, a really good Pro Bowl type corner. You beat him, you run a crossing pattern, you catch the ball, and you get 10 yards after catch for a 20-yard gain. Wasn't anything about the scheme or thinking up some tricky play. Most of the big plays Albert Wilson has had have been off schemes, bubbles, where he just pops out of the clouds, that it's something designed for him instead of him just making a play on his own. The fake punt last year against Atlanta, his biggest play as a pro. Well, that's Tobe thinking of something sneaky and tricky. So this receiving corps, sans Tyreek Hill, all are in that category. They all have to become chain movers, playmakers, and not just live off Andy Reid's creativity.
How many spots on that wide receiver corps are up for grabs right now?
It's going to be a combo. You really have to throw them in with a slash tight end slash running back. And are you going to keep four tights? How many running backs? We'll get into this in the next. We got two more weeks of doing this, and we can really start grinding the numbers, I think, after this first preseason game a bit. And for sure after the second preseason game and that last week that we do before we take a week off and then start our weekly appearances. But really look at it this way. A combo of tight end plus running back plus wide receiver. Is that a 4-4-5? Is that a 3-5-5? You could keep six wide receivers, but that means that those four of those six have got to be your four core special teams guy and potential Pro Bowl special teamers.
He's Mitch Holtis, the voice of the Chiefs. I'm Nick Schwert. It is Rock Chalk Sports Talk, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. 32-0 on the season, so after today, you're going to be encroaching upon Kentucky 2015 territory, trying to make a clean sweep. Hopefully you don't flounder in the late stages of the season like they did.
I've got my Cal haircut, actually. I've started to do my
the slick back
hair like Cal, and then I'm kind of like looking like that kind of Calipari look, where he kind of looks back. I wish I was doing a Facebook Live with you right now.
Well, you're a Midwest guy. That's an East Coast hairstyle.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just trying to. I can't find enough moose. I ask. I went up and down Mass Street, and then they said go to Papa John's because Collinsworth at 9th and Mississippi's got some moose. I go, I think that's pizza sauce.
It is. It's like Vince Vaughn in Wedding Crashers. He puts maple syrup in his hair. Bruce Collinsworth and you put pizza sauce in your hair.
It's brilliant. It's genius. I mean, he's an innovator. What can I say? He's like Chaz.
He's like Chaz, man.
Yeah. So when you go in there for pizza tonight or call out for him to deliver, it might be him. Ask him about the Alamo. Then go, do you have some hair gel in that car? So just ask.
He'll say, yeah, let me take you around back. I can't do this in front of the rest of the customers, but it's kind of like a...
Exactly.
All right, first up, Holcomb High School.
The Holcomb Longhorns. Really, this team's come on now. They have burst onto the scene, and they won a football state title in 4A2. I think they won a basketball title recently. This is one of the up-and-coming schools, of course, known in Kansas history as the site of the Clutter Murders in 1959 with a famous book, In Cold Blood, by Truman Capote. I mean, but Holcomb's making new history out there, and the Horns are winning titles.
Dodge High School? Yes.
Dodge City High School?
Dodge City, yeah, excuse me, sorry.
I'm sorry, yeah, the Red Demons, man. The Red Demons. And the Red Demons, they got one of the coolest stadiums in the state. It sits down in a natural bowl, and they've had some players. The most famous K-State KU, one of the most famous fumbles. K-State's got the game won 1973. David James is the KU quarterback. Dee Lawrence will be all over this.
Oh, yeah.
All K-State has to do is run out the clock because Don Good roughed David Sparrow, the punter, automatic first down. And Holman, what was his name? Holman from Dodge City High School, fumbles the ball. He's a K-State guy. The only fumble in his high school or college career. KU gets it. James hits Bruce Adams. Whoop, game win. KU wins. But Bill Holman, that was him, the only fumble. But Dodge City's had some really good players down through the years. The Goolsbys come from out there. And, man, Vanderbilt had a Goolsby. K-State's had a Goolsby. I think they got a Goolsby now, actually, in the K-State roster. But the Red Demons have a cool high school stadium.
Uniontown.
The Uniontown Eagles. Yeah, they, oh gosh, what was the guy's name? Levi Gillen, I think. I might be getting it mixed up with Claflin. But anyway, late 90s, the Uniontown Eagles were, they were kind of the deal, man, in 1A, 2A. Now, let's give Uniontown a big salute. Because here's my deal. I don't mind eight-man football. I like eight-man football. In fact, I love it. However, we've got a lot of schools in the state that are playing eight-man with like 35 kids out. Really? Come on now. So Uniontown went eight-man for a while. They are back to 11-man. Way to go, Uniontown. Take those kids from Fulton and all those surrounding areas near Fort Scott, and let's go Uniontown Eagles.
All right, last one, West Franklin.
Yeah, the West Franklin Falcons. That one haunts me. One of my three misses with you.
Yeah, not this year.
It was total Whit Merrifield booting the ball. Like, what? Whit Merrifield just booted a ground ball right at him. And he looks up at the sky and slams his glove to the ground. And that was, and boy, did I hear from it. And I've also told you now, though, the big key for West Franklin, Williamsburg combining with Pomona, is Appanoose Grade School.
Don't forget it.
Not far from your station. Need to go take D. Lawrence on a field trip. It kind of sets out in a field. The rumor is that the chief Appanoose, a great Native American leader, is buried right under half court of the great school gym. Just saying.
I've heard it. I've heard you say that before.
Yep. The chief Appanoose is a West Franklin Falcon fan. They use the Atlanta Falcon logo, so it's pretty cool. But sorry, West Franklin, for the booted ground ball, I think 2 years ago or maybe last year.
On the eve of the first preseason game of the year, he's Mitch Holtis. Can't wait to get you on a game day. I know things can get a little bit dicey when we talk to you on a game day. I can't wait for it.
Well, I'm going to pick out, give me the right movie to watch tonight to get fired up. I need to, you know, I'm going to go to a hotel, won't stay at home, told my wife I've got to go think about the game, and then they take you out and look at a movie. What should I watch?
How about Braveheart?
Yeah.
Is that a good one?
Yeah. And so by tomorrow, I'll have my face painted William Wallace stuff.
You have to send us a picture. I can't wait for it, Mitch. Thanks, man.
Okay, just don't let me headbutt anybody.
I can't help you, man. See ya.
Yeah, okay.
That's the voice of the Chiefs, Mitch Holtis, with us here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I'm serious, though. Getting Mitch on a game day, it's like a whole new ballgame. We'll do that tomorrow at 4:15. It's 4:33. On the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN, Scott Chasen at 5 o'clock. Coming up next, it's your Thursday news break.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Five o'clock hour here, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Royals pregame coverage starts in 25 minutes. Series finale between Kansas City and St. Louis. First pitch begins at 6:15, I believe, right here on KLWN. We got Scott Chasen, formerly of the Capital Journal, then by way of Chicago, soon to be a member of the Lawrence Journal World. Do I have that correct?
I don't even know at this point. I've changed my handle a bunch of times, so now I'm just going with like at Chasen Scott.
Yeah, why didn't you just do that? Why didn't you just do that initially?
I don't know. Have I told this story on here about me, my attempts to get the Twitter handle at Scott Chasen? Have I told that story?
No, I didn't know that, no.
So I wanted at Scott Chasen, or at least at S Chasen, because both of these are very simple, very short handles. You know, originally I had like my birth year or something in the handle, and it was like way too many characters. So I contacted both people who have it, one via way of Facebook, Twitter. One was like a professor somewhere. I literally emailed the university. That guy never got back to me. What ended up happening was I offered, I think, like $300 to each of them.
No way.
And I'm blocked by both.
They blocked you?
I got blocked by both. They were
I'll
not
give you my handle for $300.
Do you have at Derek Johnson?
Yes. It might be a little odd for you, but.
Why would he want at Derek Johnson?
I'm just saying, I'll take
$300. You know, I always thought would be cool would be to just have like at your first name.
Yeah.
Like at Scott.
Like at
Derek,
Jack. At the guy, Nick. The founder of Twitter.
The guy who is at Nick on Twitter is just some dude named Nick Fisher. He is a lead marketer at Unsplash.
Wow.
And he has almost 8,000 followers.
You have no idea though how
he is an integrated distribution solution expert.
Does this guy have tweets, though?
He hasn't tweeted since July.
Well, but that's at least, like, the guy, one of the guys I had like, 8 tweets and hadn't tweeted since, like, 2011. I'm like, dude, just give me your handle. What are you doing here?
There should be an appeals process with Twitter to say, I'm more deserving of this.
I'm the
this
most guy didn't important.
Even, this guy didn't even deserve it. He's not honoring, he's not staying true to what it means to be at Scott. At a single name Twitter handle, that's, like, pretty legit.
So speaking of self-importance, raise your hand in this room if you have applied to be verified on Twitter.
I'm not raising my hand.
Wow, I am, and no for DJ.
Let the record show that Scott is the only one who is raising his hand.
Hand up. We'll see what happens.
Why do you need? Why do you want to be? You don't deserve to be verified.
Yeah, I do.
You just write about sports.
Yeah, I think if you think about it, sports writing is the most important profession in the world.
That's
and
true.
Then second is the athletes.
That's
so. Except for the amateur ones, because you can't pay them.
That's actually a really good point. What is it? What's it mean to be verified? Like, what is the significance of it besides just, like, people knowing? Is that just it? People know you're legit?
So here's the thing about me. My senior year of high school, I moved not only schools but states. I lived in Tulsa, Oklahoma, moved to Olathe, Kansas, Olathe, Northwest. And by the end of the year, I was so ingrained, and this is, like, with a lot of tongue-in-cheek and sarcasm. I'm not sure if it's coming across right now, but I was voted most likely to be verified on Twitter. So I
that was a thing?
I have to fulfill this, or else I let my high school
down. Yeah, then you're a disappointment.
My city,
you're
an utter my town, my state. Yeah. I can't let these people down. They
you
voted
do.
Me with this honor.
You have an entire
a nation.
Township. Yeah, really for America. You need to do this for America.
If I can't achieve this thing, especially now that there are applications, and I'm talking directly to you, Jack, and the other people at Twitter, who I know, of course, you're listening to the show. What the American dream is dead.
What you need to do, honestly, now that you're big time now, you just got done working for the Cubs.
Yeah.
Ever heard of them?
yeah.
Just won the World Series. Just got done working with them, for them. Actually, they were kind of working for you, right?
I don't know. It's very much.
I mean, they have to play the games for you to write a story about.
They have
so
to talk to us.
If you look about it like that.
Yeah.
And now you're going to be joining the Lawrence Journal World.
Mm-hmm.
Or you already have joined the Lawrence
Journal World. I'm actually starting on Monday. So,
so it's for sure.
Yeah,
like there's no chance that they're gonna pull the rug out from under you after this interview.
Oh, I was gonna say maybe after they hear me on this, they're like, oh wait, this guy's coming on Rock Chalk Sports Talk. Maybe we don't want him anymore.
What are you gonna be doing for him?
So it's gonna be a good mix of stuff, covering a lot of local stuff, high school, some of the non-revenue sports, and then also a lot. You'll see me popping up at football, basketball pressers, doing kind of complimentary content, a lot of video stuff. Just trying to bring it on the analysis side. I know we're gonna try and get like a podcast started and things like that, and really go in depth with the scouting. I know recruiting is another area that, I've had some conversations about. So, I consider myself, it's funny because like you do this with players and like this guy is X player and this guy is that. I want to be the, like a complimentary piece, a guy who, hey, you're doing this content, it's great. And how can I help and share it in another way for people, my age? I'm a little bit younger, I'm 22. So, that's kind of how I see myself.
That's how I see myself, too. Mm-hmm. I like to think of myself as a complimentary player, but the problem with that is the guy I work with, Derek, he thinks, like, it's all about him.
Well, Derek's sitting behind the, whatever you would call this thing today, switchboard.
Switchboard, yeah.
So Derek's behind that. It was jarring to me.
Oh, yeah, he has to be in total control. Like,
yes.
It has to be, like, his show, his way or the highway, and I'm kind of the face of the show, but behind the scenes, he rules with an iron fist.
Well, people don't know this, but the days that Nick is supposedly out and I have to host the show, he's actually here. I just don't turn on his mic.
Yeah, and I'm just sitting here, like, waving my arms, like, trying to get a point across, and he just wouldn't allow it. He kind of rules with an iron fist. He's like he's like Oz, he's the guy behind the curtain, kind of pulling all the levers and making the weird sounds.
Well, knowing Derek and, of course, going to school with him, that's his personality type. It's always a mean
first
guy.
He's an alpha.
Yeah, just
that's
standing
what it comes
up in class.
To.
I mean, the number of classes he hijacked at KU, I couldn't even count them with, all the fingers and toes in this room.
Well, it's cool that you're going to be back, man. So you're going to be starting on Monday. You're going to be doing, you said, high school. So we'll see you at some Free State games. I'll save you a seat next to the broadcast, man.
Well, and
everybody angles for a seat right next to the broadcast group.
Well, of course. Actually, one of my final games working for the University of Daly, Kansas. So this was a few years back, but it was sitting next to the KJHK student radio announce crew. And, I never had that opportunity before to sit next to radio announcers. It was something that just my seating arrangement at Allen Fieldhouse and Memorial Stadium had never really lined up that way. And so the whole time I was kind of like listening to their play-by-play, their call of it, and watching the action. It was actually like a really exhilarating experience. So I know you're kind of joking, but that's actually like one of the most
fun things.
Well,
now you're
going to
be sitting next to a big-time crew.
Oh,
it doesn't get much bigger than me and the Bulldog, Craig Hershiser, calling Free State football.
I use your name to get into clubs all over the city.
Hey. I know Nick Schwartz. Oh, why didn't you just say, dude, you should have said something. They
everything
the
in here is yours,
for you.
And actually, we're waiving your cover charge. We're going to pay you that money
Please.
Back.
Yeah, actually, we're going to pay you to come party with us just because you said you know Nick Schwartz.
But you know, it really is just actually great to be back in Kansas City, the area. I was driving back home, and I pulled up literally my first day back in the city. I guess yesterday was my first full day or something like that, but I pulled up to a stoplight, and the guy in the car next to me is the coach of the high school I went to, the basketball coach, and I was trying to get his attention. Hey, Coach Grove, wave my arm, and he just never
waving
looked,
the arm so, at the passenger or at the driver's side of your Bugatti.
And of course. And, yeah, he never looked though, so clearly he hates me, and there's a lot of pent up animosity, probably because of that Twitter award that we talked about.
Well, so you just came from Chicago. Did mm-hmm. Chicago change you?
Oh, Chicago.
Living in
definitely
a big city change you.
We talked about this a little bit beforehand, but. You know, I got back, and I am 5'6". I like to tell people I'm 5'7" in shoes because, yeah, most of my life is in shoes. But
and the same thing with athletes. I don't know why they always do the measurements with and without shoes.
Exactly.
Ever going to play a game without shoes?
Yeah, you're going to play in shoes, so we'll go with the shoes. I'm 5'7", give or take 150, probably a little bit on the underside of that now. I feel like I can beat up anybody in the state just because Chicago has instilled that toughness, that type of mentality in me. So I guess open challenge to anyone Yeah, out there.
So you're just ready to get into like a street fight.
I think I'm going to join UFC. Does this area have that?
No, you should just patrol like Mass Street and look for like people getting mugged in back alleys.
Oh, like what is it? Like Batman, but what's the
like
word?
Any superhero?
A vigilante.
Every single superhero movie has the guy walking past an alley, some dude's trying to rip a purse off an old lady, and she's screaming help, and then that's when you come in to save the day because you've been hardened by the streets of Chicago.
Is there a lot of crime on Mass Street? I've walked it a bit. I haven't
think so, but but you could make sure that there absolutely is
you know,
no crime.
You know what would
on
happen
Mass
is
Street.
We'd set up like TV cameras to follow me around, make it a big documentary series or something like that. Then I would like hire some actors to like pretend to just to do that.
I'll do it.
And I'd walk up to them.
I'll let
and
you
they
beat
would,
me
like,
up.
Well, you would like lightly punch me, and then I would actually like collapse because turns out, you know, just living in another city does not make you the toughest human being.
Well, it's funny you say that though, because about living in a big city changing your mentality. I've never lived in a big city, but I've been to Chicago a bunch. I've been to LA a handful of times. I've been to New York mm-hmm. a couple of times. And
ever heard of it?
The big thing for me with going to those big cities is they make me a bigger jerk on the roads. Mm-hmm. Because you get to the point where you realize nothing's ever going to come of me being nice to people on the roads. Like, always letting people merge and just being polite when they don't see that the light turns green and you're just waiting there. Just give them a moment. You get to a point and you realize there's no point in being nice, so I'm just going to be a jerk to everyone. I will guarantee you there is nobody in this town who honks their horn on the road more than me.
Do you
absolutely
lay on
not.
It, or is it a quick tapping off?
Depends. It's situational. Situational. So let me give you one situation. We're at a stoplight. You're the first car. I'm right behind you. The light turns green. If you don't hit that gas immediately, you're getting a double tap.
A double tap? Wow.
A short little double tap. Two quick bursts. Beep, beep. I'm letting you know. Like, there you go. If you try to merge in front of me and almost cut me off, if you don't see me, you are getting probably a 3-second hold.
Wow.
Yeah, you're getting a because I not only do I want you to know that I'm here, I want it to sit. I want it to
you
sit
with
commit.
You. Yeah.
And I want everybody else to know how big of a jerk you are for not checking your blind spot.
And that's the truest part, because when you hear a horn like that, everyone looks around, but I'm less of a horn person. I'm more of like a gesturing angry or like an exasperation about like, how could you have possibly thought that was the right
no.
way to drive?
See,
that,
I don't do
me.
Gestures. I don't do gestures. I won't even look at you.
Ooh.
I can't even bring myself to look you in the eyes if you almost cut me off.
I like the kind of though, the squinty, the exasperated look,
palms in the air.
Yeah, and just
palms in the air. Who's that?
But not even, it's just like so confused, and you just hold it and stare at them to the point where they're driving by like, wow, like I just shattered that guy's world. He did not think it was possible to be this bad of a driver before he saw me today.
I have been known to, this is probably the most controversial situation that will garner a honk from me. Mm-hmm. I've been known to hit the horn if you're going like too far under the speed limit.
Wow.
If we're in a 35, if we're in a 45 and you're going 37, you're getting a honk.
You know,
the speed limit
that.
Is 45. And I think people don't view the speed limit properly. I think people view the speed limit as that's as fast as I can go, but I'm free to go any number under that. I disagree 100%. I think if the speed limit is 45, your range really is 40 to 50. Honestly, if it's me, your range is 46 to 55. Like, that's really what the range is. But if you're going 8 under the speed limit in a 45, you're holding up traffic. Like, you're not making the roads safer. Everybody's driving faster than you. You're holding us back. That's your problem. You're going to get a honk.
Yeah, it's something I've definitely considered, especially because, like, being in Chicago, when the traffic is really bad and you can't go the speed limit, there's nothing more frustrating. So a lot of places there are, like, 30, especially downtown. So when you get someone who's crawling along at, like, 15 to 20 and... Like, I get, dude, you're probably looking for a place or, like, trying to see an address. But, you know, like, the rest of us have to live our lives, so.
He's Scott Chasen, Lawrence Journal World. We'll come back and do a little bit more with Scott on the other side. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
FM 521, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. With Derek Johnson, I'm Nick Schwert. We've got Scott Chasen of the Lawrence Journal World in studio with us. Only about 10 minutes left in the show. I gotta stop gambling, man. These golf gambling bets every single weekend. They gotta start.
I thought you were on a hot streak.
Well, I'm on a hot streak of picking guys who are in the conversation. But like I told you in the end of the 4 o'clock hour, gambling. When you gamble on golf, it's different. You're not just gambling on the winner because there's 150 guys in the tournament. If you're gambling on a guy, you're hoping he can make the cut. After that, you're hoping he can get a late Sunday tee time. After that, you're hoping he can, you know, drop a few putts. It's really hard to get all of those things. Mm-hmm. So I can bet on 9 guys who I've pegged to play really well. And guess what? They can all play well. They can all make the cut. And at that point, the odds of one of them winning are still astronomically low. It's a terrible gamble, but I can't stop doing it.
Well, you know what you need to pivot to? It's, you know, a lot of this happens overseas, I've been told, but especially in, like, England. So you remember that, like, Leicester City won the Premier League
at
5,000 to 1 odds. Well, apparently it's really big over there that you can sell back your ticket. Like, so, for example, I'll give an example. They won their first game, and somebody sold back his ticket and made, like, 25 cents. So then, as they actually started, like, being in contention and later, more and more people were selling it back and getting, like, not 5,000 to 1, but maybe like 200 to 1 payouts on what their money. And, you know, at a certain point, you would take that and say, yeah, give me 300 to 1, 400 to 1 odds on that. So you just got to go to England, man.
I just got to go to England. Do you gamble at all?
So interesting you would ask that, especially because we talked about it a little bit in the break. So it's kind of like pulling back the curtain here. But
hey,
no,
don't pull it back so much. All right.
Sorry.
That's our little show for each other. You know, we do little private shows other during the break. You don't need to let everybody in.
Actually, it was as we're literally going back on the air, I whisper to him, hey, ask me about Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. And it's supposed to be like, oh, wow, can't believe that conversation came up.
And then the professional, Nick Schwert, just like randomly starts, man, I got to stop gambling.
Sabotaging it, man.
Oh, so perfect.
That was a perfect segue.
That was perfect. I am so in awe that I am thrown off my own game by just how perfect of a radio host you are. But
good
save. So it was the day before the MLB All-Star break, and I'm sitting in the media, like, lunchroom watching some NBA Summer League on TV, and the main MLB.com beat writer turns to me and says, wow, you really like this stuff, huh? I was like, yeah. And she goes, well, why don't you just go to Vegas over the All-Star break? And it was like something clicked in my head, and 24 hours later, I was on a plane with Chris Bryant. He got to board before me.
You and Chris Bryant went to Vegas together.
Well, there were about 300 other people on the plane, but yes.
So you guys weren't, like, you didn't.
No, Chris Bryant wanted to go with Scott, like, hey, but Scott, he was like, no.
You doing
but he
anything?
Got priority boarding, and they said the name, and they were like, Bryant. And I was like, hold on. I was like, this dude and me, what's the difference between us?
What if he would have turned around and be like, Scott, you want to hop on with me, man?
Well, I would have been like, how did you learn my name? But that's okay.
Chris Bryant doesn't know your name.
I introduce myself to a lot of people, but very rarely the people who are surrounded by like 300 other people.
Hey, Scott, what's up? Good to see you again.
But anyway, so I go to Vegas, and I'm not much of a gambler. I like poker. I'll play like Texas Hold'em, and I've done like, when I say a few tournaments, I mean like 2 to 3 very low, you know, whatever tournaments in my life.
Low stakes, yeah.
But you have to throw down a bet there. So I'm looking at the board and thinking, like, should I just bet a few bucks on the Patriots to win a Super Bowl? Or you could bet on the Summer League games. I was like, maybe throw down a couple bucks on the Suns, who I'm, you know, I want to see Josh Jackson, Frank Mason, and guys like that who I got to cover. So maybe bet on them. That'd be cool. But then I was like, you know what? If I'm going to lay down a bet, I'm not doing it to make money. I'm not in this to put down $20 to make $20. That seems very stupid
and
superficial.
Right, exactly.
So what I decided on doing was I put down $40 on the Chiefs to win the Super Bowl at 25-1. So that would be an $1,000 payout, which I'm not banking on accepting or getting back. but it was the first like legitimate sports bet I put down.
Really?
So seemed pretty cool. I got my ticket, and then I'm fully expecting to frame that along with a wristband. Daryl Morey, the Houston Rockets general manager, hosts this party, this like ping pong tournament for NBA executives, media, and player. And somehow I found myself sneaking into that with some friends. We got like wristbands for it, though.
What the hell happened to you, man?
Vegas,
you're so
was
big
weird.
Time now.
Chicago, Vegas. So anyway, I think that's all going to be like part of my Vegas. Like I'm going to frame both of those once that ticket is invalid. I'm still holding out hope.
So you're best friends with Chris Bryant and Daryl Morey now.
Yeah, we go to parties and things like that. You know it's a cool
Literally.
Party. This is the nerdiest, the lamest thing in the world. But you can get free drinks in Vegas for doing anything. You start gambling at a table, they give you free drinks. You know it's a cool place. When they're bringing around water bottles. Once they start giving away free water bottles, you know, like, because everything else is already free. But now, like, here's a smart, and it's not like a cheap one. It's like the half liter smart water type deal. You know
that
you
is
have
big
landed
time.
Somewhere exclusive.
I feel like a little bit of pressure to perform. And I didn't know I was in the presence of somebody who aligns himself with greatness. I wouldn't call you greatness yet, but you align yourself with greatness.
I would say I aligned myself and stood out amongst greatness in a bad way in that when we were going to this thing, I didn't quite put two and two together. And we were coming after, you know, spending the day watching summer league games. So we'd been at, you know, this basketball gym. So I was like in shorts and like a polo shirt. So I show up to this thing thinking, yeah, it's a ping pong tournament. I'm wearing like athletic shorts like I'm wearing right now. And everyone else is like decked out in suits. And I was just like, I don't
see. So you stuck out like really bad?
I'd like to pretend I didn't because the lights were kind of dark in there. So I was like, I forget what color they were, but I think they were like blue.
How many people were there?
God, I'm bad at estimating, but I would say a couple hundred.
So there's a good chance that at least one person was like, who's that really short guy wearing athletic shorts?
There was a good chance that like 199 people were like, how did this kid wander in here and where are his parents?
But, you know, maybe some people thought he was like a millionaire. We've talked about this before. Like, once you hit that certain level of rich,
that's true.
You just stop caring about what you wear.
Yeah, so because
maybe
like really, really rich people, really rich people, they're going to wear $1,000 Armani suits. They're going to be decked out and diamond studded, this, that, wristwatches, you know, $10,000 Rolex. And then you get to like wealthy. You get to like billionaire status. You get to Zuckerberg, Steve Jobs status. And then you regress when it comes to fashion. You're just t-shirt and jeans. You know why? Because nobody can tell me what to do.
Honestly, I think that might be the strategy I start going with, like showing up in like a tank top and shorts places.
They're going to be like,
and
he's wealthy. He's
don't you know who I am?
Are you kidding me? If that guy's wearing that to this, he must really be powerful.
It did not quite work as well, though. Afterward, there's like this bar in the roof of somewhere that you can, it's like got a great view that you can go out and see like the city and things like that. And we wanted to go up there. And the guy was like, yeah, we kind of have a dress code. And we were like, well, so what would it take for us to get in? And he's like, well, if you buy this like $300 bottle of something. And we were like, oh, thank you very much.
She said, how about I buy your life, bro?
Ooh, that's good. I like the don't you know who I am thing. That's like the best thing you can
turn around to your friends, kind of laugh, like chuckle to yourself. Kind of you look around and you go, you know who I am, right?
Yeah.
And then he'll feel stupid for not knowing who you are, and then he'll let you in.
I party with Daryl Morey all the time, guys.
Let's see here. I flew out here with Chris Bryant, and I just got done partying with Daryl Morey. Ever heard of those guys? He's like, I'm sorry, sir, please, after me. Let me take you to your table.
Yeah, and you know, big city guy, Chicago to Vegas. You know, that's just how I spend all my life. You know, I'm just a whatever. I don't name myself. I let you guys do that.
Scott Chasen, now of the Lawrence Journal World. Good to have you back, man.
Good to be back.
We'll be visiting with you shortly. We'll be seeing you around, man. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Rob.
He's Scott Chasen. I'm Nick Schwert. For Derek Johnson, that's going to do it for Rock Chalk Sports Talk. We'll see you tomorrow at 3 o'clock right here on KLWN. Royals baseball coming up next.